Hi, everybody. Good morning. Welcome to Bio 231, Human Anatomy. We're going to finish up autonomic nervous system today and move into senses. And senses are what we're going to do in lab today as well. So we're going to do an eyeball dissection. Don't forget, you need toe protection, hand protection, eye protection. And if you don't have gloves, goggles or glasses, safety glasses and shoes, you got a half hour between lecture and lab to go find those things, right? So you have to have that. I see you're wearing shoes. Very good, very good. All right. Does anybody have any questions about anything before we look at the schedule? Yeah, there was a question? No? Okay. All right, let's take a look at the schedule. What is today? Today is the 16th. Indeed it is. So we're going to get into special senses. We've got to finish up autonomic nervous system. And we don't have an exam Monday, but we have one on Tuesday. We have a lecture on endocrine system on Monday. And if that's the first time when you start studying the endocrine system, that's probably not enough time to know it very well for the exam the very next day. So hopefully you've been looking at it already. If not, start looking at it today, working the study guide. And, you know, I hope you get started today if you haven't started already, okay, because you just have to have time to let some of these things sink in. Okay, so that's the story for lecture. And then on Wednesday, we're going to have our third practicum. And I do believe Jessica is going to be in lab on Monday the 20th and Tuesday the 21st to help us out with reviewing and making sure we know everything for that third practicum. So that is the schedule. Anybody got a question on the schedule? Pretty much up to date with that. One thing I didn't mention is Friday night. What do you have to do by Friday night? Yeah, your online assignments, right? So make sure that you're current with that. I haven't looked at those in a couple weeks. So I can't comment on how everybody's doing. But I'll probably go in there really soon. And if you didn't do one of those assignments, I got to put a zero in there. Right? Zeros are really hard to average out to a decent grade. So at least get a couple points for those online quizzes. All right, autonomic nervous system. Let's review real quick. As far as the motor division of your nervous system, we can break it down into two main categories. Autonomic nervous system is one. What is the other main category? Somatic. Yeah, somatic. And when you think somatic, the connotation is voluntary control, right? And what is the effector organ for the somatic motor nervous system? It's skeletal muscle. Yeah, skeletal muscle. And remember, skeletal muscle is attached to your skeleton. When that muscle contracts, your skeleton moves. And skeletal muscle can never make up a decision, can never change its mind whether it's going to contract or not. When it gets a signal from that motor neuron, it just contracts no matter what. That's its only chance. That's all that it can do. All right, so somatic is one division. Autonomic is another. And the autonomic nervous system can be broken down into two divisions. And you got to know those two divisions. What are the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system? I like sympathetic. I heard sympathetic and parasympathetic. What's the relationship between the two? Yeah, they're antagonistic to each other, right? Gas pedal, brake pedal. So when these things go to various parts of your body, that nervous system has precise control and balance over those organs, for instance, like the heart. And they're going to be antagonistic to each other. So if the parasympathetic nervous system slows the heart down, you know what the sympathetic nervous system does. It speeds the heart up, right? Okay, so that's just some good basic architecture. But the neuroanatomy that you have to know, right, comparing somatic with autonomic nervous system, a similarity is that the cell bodies of these motor neurons are in the central nervous system, and then they leave. For somatic motor outflow, there is just one neuron all the way to the effector organ. The neurotransmitter at the effector organ is acetylcholine and is always 100% stimulatory or excitatory. It's going to cause that muscle to contract. And in the autonomic nervous system, okay, we see that there are two neurons from central nervous system to effector organ. And you know the effector organs. Go ahead, tell me the effector organs. Tell me one. Smooth muscle. Tell me another one. Cardiac. And? Glands. That's right. These things are controlled autonomically or automatically for you. It doesn't require your conscious thought. And so it requires two neurons. And the second neuron, which we call the postganglionic neuron, is out in the periphery someplace. It's not in the central nervous system, so the cell body is in the periphery, and there's going to be a group of these in a certain area. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? Group of nerve cell bodies. As compared to a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system. We want to think of nuclei and ganglii, right? And a ganglion is in the peripheral nervous system, and that's what we see right here for autonomic outflow. Here's a ganglion. So it's going to be a little nodule someplace. So the first neuron is what we call presynaptic. The second one is the postsynaptic neuron because there's a synapse, nice chemical synapse between these two. And the neurotransmitter is acetylcholine, like it is for the somatic motor neuron. All right, the postsynaptic neuron doesn't release acetylcholine. It releases norepinephrine. That's the neurotransmitter. So that's nice and important to know for sympathetic nervous system, okay, norepinephrine. You see that there's a lot of divergence of signals. So sympathetic stimulation is, has a divergent effect in the body. It affects all organs pretty much at the same time. And let's see, the preganglionic fiber is myelinated. Postganglionic fiber is not myelinated. The preganglionic fiber for sympathetic is relatively short. The post is relatively long. And if we contrast that, actually we want to compare and contrast with the parasympathetic nervous system, we see that the preganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine, exactly the same as the sympathetic outflow pathway. But in the parasympathetic nervous system, the postganglionic fiber does not release norepinephrine, it releases acetylcholine as the neurotransmitter. There is a ganglion as well, and the neurotransmitter within that ganglion is acetylcholine like it was in the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so it is required to have two neurons, a pre- and postganglionic fiber, to get to these effector organs for autonomic outflow. And there's some differences. All right, here is a nice special case where this rule is violated. Right, I only see a preganglionic fiber in this particular case going to the adrenal medulla. Remember, that's the deep part of the adrenal medulla. And if this was the typical kind of architecture that we see in this very top row, then there would be a neuron here that would send an electrical impulse someplace and release norepinephrine at some distant location. But that's not the case. Right? These cells in the adrenal medulla don't send electrical impulses long distances. When they are stimulated by acetylcholine from the preganglionic fiber, they directly release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the blood, and then the blood carries that sympathetic signal everywhere in the body. Right? So there's only a preganglionic fiber. These cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fiber. Okay, but in this particular case, they're acting more like an endocrine gland, and norepinephrine and epinephrine are acting more like a hormone than a neurotransmitter. Right? But probably it's best to think of epinephrine and norepinephrine secreted by the adrenal medulla as neurohormones. They have characteristics of both. All right, so that's a nice comparison between somatic and autonomic outflow, comparison between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. So this is a pretty important slide. And we showed you this one last time. I see the brain, I see spinal cord, and I see that parasympathetic outflow leads the central nervous system from cranial nerves, primarily number 10. What's the name for number 10? This is a vagus nerve, right? So you can see that vagus nerve just wanders around all over in the body, exciting your heart, lungs, liver, stomach, or digestive tract, right, pancreas. So parasympathetic outflow leaves the CNS via some cranial nerves and a few sacral nerves. So therefore we say parasympathetic outflow is craniosacral. And that's going to be different compared to the sympathetic nervous system. And because this vagus nerve wanders around all over the place, that's how it got named. All right, what would you name a person that wanders around all the time and that label starts with a V? A vagabond, that's right. That's how this, so vagabond and vagus are synonymous but in two different languages. Okay. Parasympathetic outflow goes discreetly to one organ, like the heart, for instance, without stimulating the other organ. So it's very discreet. All right. And that's good. That's good. Let's look at this one right here. So I see brain and spinal cord. Here's another autonomic outflow scheme. I don't see any autonomic nerves leaving the brain. I don't see any leaving the sacral region. I don't see any leaving the cervical region. But I see some nerves leaving the thoracic and lumbar region. Right? And so this can't be parasympathetic because we know parasympathetic is craniosacral. This one right here is what we call thoracolumbar. And this is how sympathetic outflow leaves the central nervous system. From T1 to L2, not cranial sacral like parasympathetic nervous system. So these are all the preganglionic fibers, right? And they go into the sympathetic chain, and you can see that there are ganglia in the sympathetic chain, and they might synapse here, or maybe the preganglionic fiber passes right through the sympathetic chain to another ganglion someplace that is in front of the spinal cord. So the sympathetic chain are on either side of the vertebral column. So these sometimes we call the paravertebral because they're on either side. Right? And then these other ganglia, we can call these collateral ganglia or prevertebral ganglia because they are anterior to the vertebral column. Right? But they perform the same kind of function. This is the junction between the presynaptic and postsynaptic cell. And the neurotransmitter, you should know the neurotransmitter at all of these ganglia right here. Anybody remember what that neurotransmitter is? That is secreted by the preganglionic fiber that excites the postganglionic fiber is acetylcholine. Yeah, it's acetylcholine. All autonomic ganglia, right, have acetylcholine or use acetylcholine as the neurotransmitter. All right, and then these sympathetic signals go to various places. Like here's one that goes to the heart. And just for fun, tell me, what's the effect of sympathetic stimulation on the heart? Excitatory or inhibitory? Yeah, that you just probably should memorize. Think of what? Fight or flight mechanism. And the sympathetic nervous system responds, right, under those circumstances. So when you're fighting or flying away, what is your heart activity? Is it quiet or speeds up? Speeds up, right? So always think of rest and digest for parasympathetic nervous system or fight and flight for sympathetic nervous system. That's a really handy way to remember these things. Okay, so sympathetic chain ganglia or paravertebral ganglia, right? Or else the presynaptic neuron goes all the way to a collateral ganglia or prevertebral ganglia someplace. Let's look at a nice pathway for some kind of signal. Okay, so here we see vertebral bodies, and here's the spinal cord. And what do I have the cursor on right now? Yeah, ganglia. And what kind of ganglia? I would see these on either side of the vertebral column, and they're all joined together. So these are what we call the sympathetic chain ganglia, right? They have to do with sympathetic nervous system only, not parasympathetic, right? And since they're on either side of the vertebral column, sometimes we call these the paravertebral ganglia, right? Sympathetic chain ganglia or paravertebral. So how do signals get in here? Well, I see a spinal cord, and I see a couple roots coming out of the spinal cord or being attached to the spinal cord. Which one of these roots right here is actually sending signals away from the central nervous system? Where do I have the cursor? I was going to ask you, what's the name of this root right here? That's a nice big lead line that tells you. This is the ventral root, right? And then here's a dorsal root. Here's a dorsal root ganglia for sensory information. Oh, I just told you then that the ventral root is responsible for signals leaving the CNS. And what's a good way to talk about systems or nerves that take signals away from the CNS? How would you talk about those? How would you call them? How would you name them? Two ways. They could be efferent neurons or motor neurons. Efferent and motor are exactly the same thing. All right, so sympathetic impulses leave the central nervous system. And how do they leave? Through the thoracolumbar region, not craniosacral, because that's parasympathetic. So thoracolumbar region leaves the ventral root. And the preganglionic fiber, is it myelinated or not myelinated? Myelinated or unmyelinated? Okay, the preganglionic is myelinated. So is it going to look like gray matter or white matter? White matter, yeah, if it's myelinated. So here I see a couple bridges between the spinal nerve and the sympathetic chain ganglia. These are what we call rami communicantes or communicans. One is white, one is gray. So which one has the preganglionic fiber going through it? Well, we said that the preganglionic fiber is myelinated, so it is this one right here. The white ramus communicans has the preganglionic fiber entering the sympathetic chain, and if it synapses on the postsynaptic or postganglionic fiber, okay, then that postganglionic fiber might leave the sympathetic chain, go back into the spinal nerve, and then go to whatever part of the body it's designed to go to. And since the postganglionic fiber is unmyelinated, this rami communicans is gray. All right, so you got white for the preganglionic, gray for the postganglionic, and that's because those axons are either myelinated or unmyelinated. So that's kind of easy to tell. All right, so why do things go into the sympathetic chain? Well, autonomic outflow, as a rule, requires a preganglionic and a postganglionic fiber, two of them. All right, so let's do a nice tracing of a pathway to some effector organ, like maybe a gland or a smooth muscle in your skin, like this erector pili muscle. All right, so the cell body for the preganglionic autonomic motor neuron, which is sympathetic, is in the lateral horn. Right, and then the axon leaves, it goes through this, since it's motor, this is what, the anterior funiculus, goes into the ventral root, joins with the spinal nerve, and it goes through the white rami communicantes, and here it ends in this ganglia. Here's the cell body of the postganglionic fiber, right, so there's going to be a collection of these nerve cell bodies in this swelling right here. That's why we call it a ganglion, because it's in the peripheral nervous system. So now we have the postganglionic fiber sending an axon out through the gray ramus communicans back into the spinal nerve, and then that axon is going to go to whatever effector organ, right, that is designed to go to. In this particular case, it might be a gland in the skin, or maybe this erector pili muscle, or something like that. All right. Well, these ganglia on either side of the vertebral column are connected together, right? I see a connection here and a connection there. Why is that? All right, because there can be circumstances where the preganglionic fiber that I see right here, cell body in the lateral horn of the spinal cord, leaves the ventral root, goes into the spinal nerve, enters the sympathetic chain via the white rami communicans, right, because it's a myelinated fiber, gets into the sympathetic chain, but doesn't synapse in that ganglia right there, but it can ascend. It can ascend a number of different levels, right, where it synapses on the postganglionic fiber, right, and then the postganglionic fiber exits sympathetic chain with this gray rami communicans into the spinal nerve, which is above the one that it entered, right, and then it's going to go to its particular effector organ. So this connection allows for sympathetic signals to either ascend or descend through the sympathetic chain, allowing it to get to various other parts of the body. So that's why these things are connected together. All right, so here is another scheme. So here we got spinal cord. lateral horn, cell body for the preganglionic fiber, and it leaves the ventral root, gets into the sympathetic chain via the white rami communicans, but notice that it does not synapse in the sympathetic chain ganglia. This axon is passing right through, and it's going to some other location in the body where there is another type of ganglia. It's not a sympathetic chain. This is the collateral or prevertebral ganglia, right? And it's a ganglion because there's going to be a group of these nerve cell bodies that I'm pointing to right here. These are in front of the vertebral column. That's why we might call these the prevertebral ganglia. But nonetheless, there has to be a ganglia, right? Because it requires two cells for this sympathetic outflow. And then this the postganglionic fiber sends an axon to the effector organ or target tissue, right? And this would be smooth muscle in this particular case. This connection between the sympathetic chain and the prevertebral ganglia always has a particular name, right? And there are many of these, but they all pretty much have the same name, and this is what we call a splanchnic nerve. A splanchnic nerve is for sympathetic outflow, but it contains preganglionic fibers that are passing straight through the sympathetic chain going to a prevertebral ganglia someplace. That's a splanchnic nerve. All right, so let me see if I can show you a couple splanchnic nerves someplace. We actually saw them already. And let's look at this illustration here. All right, so here we have thoracolumbar outflow, right? And so is that sympathetic or parasympathetic outflow? Thoracolumbar. Sympathetic or parasympathetic? Okay, parasympathetic is craniosacral. Sympathetic is thoracolumbar. So this is an illustration of pathways for the sympathetic nervous system. These are all preganglionic fibers entering the sympathetic chain via the white rami communicans or communicantes. Some of these preganglionic fibers pass straight through the sympathetic chain without synapsing, and I see them here, and here, and here, and here, and all of these nerves passing straight through the sympathetic chain are what we call what? Splanchnic nerve. Splanchnic nerve. What's this one over here? Splanchnic nerve. What is over here? Splanchnic nerve, right? So splanchnic nerves contain axons from preganglionic fibers taking signals to these prevertebral ganglia where they synapse on the postganglionic fiber. What's the neurotransmitter that's used in the sympathetic nervous system between the preganglionic and postganglionic cell, even in these prevertebral ganglia? It's always going to be acetylcholine, right? Acetylcholine all the time in ganglia, whether it's parasympathetic or sympathetic, it does not matter. All right. But the neurotransmitter from the postganglionic fiber in the sympathetic nervous system is going to be different, and it is norepinephrine. 99% of the time it's norepinephrine, right? So at the ganglia, it's acetylcholine. At the effector organ, it is norepinephrine for the sympathetic nervous system. Okay, so that is important. The only thing that's a little strange with this sympathetic outflow is when you consider, right, sympathetic outflow to the adrenal medulla, right? And see, here I see a nerve right here, a splanchnic nerve, right? So that means that this nerve passes straight through the sympathetic chain, right? And it actually passes right through this collateral ganglia and it goes all the way to the adrenal medulla. So this is the preganglionic fiber right here. And the cells of the adrenal medulla act like the postganglionic cells. And what does a postganglionic neuron secrete as a neurotransmitter in the sympathetic nervous system? It is norepinephrine. Yeah, norepinephrine. But this is the preganglionic fiber that goes to the adrenal medulla. What does the preganglionic fiber secrete on the adrenal medulla to get it to release norepinephrine and epinephrine? The neurotransmitter, since this is a preganglionic fiber, all the time it is acetylcholine. The preganglionic fiber always releases acetylcholine, and it doesn't matter if it's the parasympathetic or the sympathetic autonomic nervous system. The preganglionic fiber always releases acetylcholine. Okay, so here are a number of really good questions. Hopefully you can have a good picture in your mind about these things. So let me just read some of these questions and see if I still think they're good. Do you think it would be a good idea to have tonic or antagonistic control over important body functions such as heart rate? Tonic just means one, like excitatory only or inhibitory only. Antagonistic means what? Being able to mix both excitatory and inhibitory signals together. All right, so for controlling your heart, what would be better, tonic or antagonistic control? Antagonistic control, just like your car. You just don't want to have a gas pedal, right? Because then when you got home, you couldn't stop. And if you only had a brake pedal, well, you couldn't even start to go home, right? All right, so that's a good one. So here's another good question. These are really wordy, but we got to understand these words. Are the pre- and postganglionic fibers of the parasympathetic nervous system cholinergic or adrenergic? I'm glad I read this because I haven't mentioned. If a neuron releases acetylcholine, it's called a cholinergic neuron. So in your notes, put ACH, maybe right above cholinergic. That's just how we talk about those things. If it releases norepinephrine, we say it is adrenergic. Right, that neuron is an adrenergic neuron. The receptors are adrenergic if they can bind norepinephrine. All right, so remember we said that the adrenal medulla can secrete norepinephrine and epinephrine, right, which are sympathetic excitatory chemicals. Another name for epinephrine is adrenaline. Have you heard of adrenaline before? Probably. Adrenaline, right, is it? It excites your sympathetic nervous system, increases your heart rate. All right, so adrenaline and epinephrine are exactly the same compound. We talked about norepinephrine. That is the same thing as noradrenaline, but typically in everyday language we don't say noradrenaline, we just say adrenaline, right? But they're the same thing. But that's why when neurons release norepinephrine, we call that an adrenergic neuron, because adrenaline and epinephrine are the same compound. All right, so to answer this question, are the pre- and postganglionic fibers of the parasympathetic nervous system cholinergic or adrenergic? The parasympathetic nervous system always releases acetylcholine, and hence they are cholinergic neurons. Okay? They're not adrenergic. How would you describe the difference between the pre- and postganglionic neurons of the parasympathetic nervous system? Okay, we've done that. The pre is myelinated. The preganglionic fiber is relatively short. The postganglionic fiber is relatively long and it's non-myelinated. The preganglionic releases acetylcholine, so the preganglionic neuron for the sympathetic nervous system is cholinergic. The postganglionic neuron in the sympathetic nervous system is adrenergic. So that's a good way to think of those. How would you describe the difference between the pre- and postganglionic neurons of the sympathetic nervous system? Okay, sympathetic nervous system. Sympathetic nervous system, if we look at this chart right here, the preganglionic fiber is relatively short. Most of them only go into the sympathetic chain. Then the postganglionic fibers are long. Acetylcholine is used at the ganglia, so the preganglionic fiber is cholinergic, but the postganglionic fiber in the sympathetic nervous system is adrenergic because it releases norepinephrine. All right, next question. Why is the white ramus communicans white, or why is the gray ramus communicans gray? Let's start with the first one. Why is the white ramus communicans white? Why does it look white? Because, yeah, those axons in there, the preganglionic axons, are myelinated, right? The gray ramus communicantes contains axons of the postganglionic fiber, and those are non-myelinated, and so it's going to have a gray appearance. That's all there's to that. Name the nerve that connects sympathetic chain with a collateral or prevertebral ganglia. I see it on this slide over here. Here's a sympathetic chain. Here's a prevertebral ganglia. What are we going to call these nerves right here? These are splanchnic nerves. Splanchnic nerves. They're different kinds depending on where they are in the body, right? Greater splanchnic, lesser splanchnic, but they're all going to be lumbar splanchnic, sacral splanchnic, but they're all going to be a splanchnic nerve. And they contain preganglionic axons. What's the general name for the chemicals, norepinephrine and epinephrine, which are secreted from the adrenal medulla? So here's that adrenal medulla. There are like pseudo or quasi postganglionic cells there. What do those cells release? They're not really neurons, so would you call it a neurotransmitter? A neuron secretes a neurotransmitter, but these cells here are acting more like an endocrine gland. So you might think, well, gee whiz, norepinephrine and epinephrine might be here considered a hormone. But since these cells are acting like the postganglionic fiber, they're acting like a neurotransmitter as well. So these things, right, from the adrenal medulla would be considered neurohormones. So here is a nice interface between the nervous system and endocrine system. Are the quasi-postganglionic cells of the adrenal medulla nerve cells or endocrine cells? Well, again, it's hard to say exactly what they are. They have characteristics of both. So you could call those neuroendocrine cells in the adrenal medulla right here. They have acetylcholine receptors, just like all of the other postganglionic fibers in the autonomic nervous system, but they don't send nerve impulses. They directly release norepinephrine and epinephrine into the blood. What's the general name for the chemical norepinephrine, which is secreted from a postganglionic sympathetic neuron? So you should be aware that a postganglionic sympathetic neuron actually does secrete norepinephrine. Right, you should know that. And what's the general name for norepinephrine secreted by these neurons? What kind of signaling compound is secreted by a neuron? And it's a name that would apply to a whole, to everything that is secreted by a neuron. It is a neurotransmitter, right? And norepinephrine is just the specific name of one type of neurotransmitter. Give me a name of another kind of neurotransmitter. Acetylcholine, yeah, which we talked about, right? And then there's others too, serotonin, dopamine, there's many different kinds. Even some amino acids act as neurotransmitters. All right, so that's it for the autonomic nervous system. So what do you have to remember? What did we talk about today that's really kind of strange? Well, the outflow pathways are different. Sympathetic and parasympathetic are different. Remember, parasympathetic is craniosacral. That's not shown on this slide here, right? But what is shown on this slide here is thoracolumbar, and that is how sympathetic signals leave the central nervous system. So the sympathetic nervous system is thoracolumbar. Parasympathetic is craniosacral. And in most cases, it requires a preganglionic and postganglionic cell to get to its effector organ. And you know the effector organs are cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands, which is what you see in this column right here. Okay, and just remember that when you compare parasympathetic and sympathetic, they're just going to have opposite effects, right, because of antagonism. Okay, who's got a question on autonomic nervous system? Autonomic nervous system, not too many questions. Okay. Well, I'm going to put that away. Put that away. And what do I want? Oh, wow. Did I close all that down already? Oh, no, it's over here. All right, so this is kind of a fun chapter. Senses is a fun chapter. Where are senses? Here are senses. Okay, and as a matter of fact, we're going to call these special senses. So we can classify sensation in our body into two groups. The first group is what we call general sensation, and the second group is what we call special sensation. And the difference is easy to understand. If you have receptors all over your body for a particular modality of energy, we call that a general sense. If you have receptors for that, a particular kind of energy in one, maybe two locations in your body only, then we call that a special sense. Okay? So if it's all over your body, that is general. If it's only in one or two locations, that's special. So what about temperature? Is that general or special? Let me take an ice cube and put it on your earlobe. Can you feel it? Yeah, because you have temperature receptors there. How about if I put it on your kneecap? Can you feel that ice cube? Yeah, how about if I put it on your belly button, on your back someplace, right? You'll be able to tell me that it's cold. So temperature sensation is a general sense because you have thermal receptors all over the body, okay? What about if I took a pin and poked you in your wrist? Could you tell me that you experience pain there? Sure, you have pain receptors there. What about your big toe? If I stuck a pin in your big toe, could you tell that you have tissue damage taking place there? Yes. Pain receptors are all over your body. So what kind of sense is that? General or special? That is still general, right? Because you have those receptors all over the body. Okay. Now, let's take a sugar cube. And a sugar cube will give you a sense of taste, right? We call that a gustatory sense. And if I put that sugar cube on your belly button, can you taste it? No. If I put it on your kneecap, can you taste it? No. All right, I put it on your earlobe, can't taste it. Where do we have to put that sugar cube in order for you to taste it? And that is only on your tongue. One location can you experience what that sugar cube contains. And so in that particular case, is taste or gustation a special sense or a general sense? It's special because there's only one location. All right. What about detecting light? I got a flashlight, and I'm going to shine a flashlight only on your belly button. Can you see it? Only on your belly button? No. If I shine on your kneecap, can you see it? Shine on your nose, can you see it? Earlobe, can you see it? No. If I shine it in your eye, can you see it? Yes. All right, so is vision a special or general sense? It's special, right? Because there's only one location on either side of your body that can detect light. So it's a special sensation with special kinds of receptors. Okay, so what are the special senses? We got five of them. Oh, I don't have a nice list of this. I'll go over it really fast. Olfaction is one, right? And olfaction is the sense of smell. Gustation is two. That's the sense of taste. Three is vision, right? That's for, you all know what vision is, to detect light. Vision is one. And, we've got to go way down here. Hearing. I don't know why I have it in such small letters. Hearing is another one, right, in your ears. And then there is balance. And that's also in your ears. And there's two kinds of balance, static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium, and that's all of the special senses that you have, right? This equilibrium sense is, you can only detect, right, these kinds of accelerations only in your ear. That's the only place, so it's a special sense. All right, so these are special senses. So let's go back up to olfaction. And this might take you back to some bone anatomy. All right, so what part of the brain are you aware of that has to do with olfaction? You have to know this. Oh, and you're going to have to know this when we get into the nervous system. And you know what? You probably haven't studied this just yet. Okay, you learned about the olfactory foramina in the ethmoid bone, and that's a place where olfactory nerves leave the central nervous system to get into the nasal cavity. Right, and so here's a special part of the brain called the olfactory bulb, right? And that's cranial nerve number one, and it sends nerve fibers down into your nasal cavity. And this is the only place I know of where you actually have part of your nervous system dangling in space outside your body. Right? And as a result, these neurons don't live a very long time because everything you breathe in, your nose, can attach to these neurons right here. Many things are toxic and can kill these cells, right, and then you lose the sense of smell. So molecules have to enter the nasal cavity. We call those odorant molecules. They have to bind to these neurons, and then when they bind, they change the electrical properties of that neuron, which sends signals to the olfactory lobe of the brain for your sensation of smell. And notice, these nerves are way up on the roof of the nasal cavity, not down over here on the floor of the nasal cavity. So if you want to get a good sense of what something smells like, what do you have to do? Maybe you're a wine connoisseur, and you really want to get a good sense of what that wine is like. What do you have to do? Okay, you have to inhale, right? And actually, you have to get a lot of airflow up in this region, so we call that sniffing, right? You have to go like that to make sure that this place over here has good airflow through it so those odorant molecules can bind to these receptors. Okay, so here's the olfactory bulb, and then those signals enter the central nervous system. These are myelinated axons. What do we call a bunch of myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system? It's white matter. So what do we call white matter in the CNS? It's a tract, right? So here is the olfactory tract. Going to look at brain today in lab. All right, so olfactory tract right here. Olfactory bulb, olfactory tract. You won't be able to see these nerves at all. Okay, so you got odorant molecules have to bind to receptors, changes the electrical properties in the olfactory nerves, and you got to know the name of that cranial nerve, right? The most anterior one, cranial nerve number one, or the olfactory. And we can break down our sensation of smell into various kinds of categories, but it's very complicated. We might have thousands of different kinds of receptors for different kinds of compounds, so it's a very advanced kind of sense. We can distinguish things that have a flowery sense or an etheric sense or musky sense or sweet or rotten, stinging sense with our nose, and this is just a really short list of odorant types of molecules, unlike you're going to see for taste. All right, so let's take a look at this slide right here. Here's the olfactory bulb, and then here are mitral cells that send axons into the central nervous system, right? So this is the white matter entering the central nervous system. Here are the olfactory cells, and these are neurons. What by shape, what kind of neuron is this one right here, and this one here, and this one here, and this one here? Doesn't look multipolar. Doesn't look pseudo-unipolar. I see one, two processes coming directly from the cell body, so that is a bipolar neuron. All right, so bipolar neuron function is sensory, but only for special senses. So here's the epithelium that is lining your nasal cavity, and it's a membrane. What kind of membrane would this be? Anybody remember what kind of membrane would this be? Two major kinds of membranes. One that lines the cavity not open to the outside world, another that lines the cavity open to the outside world. This is open to the outside world, so this is a mucous membrane. And it just so happens that it does secrete mucus, right? So here's a membrane open to the outside world. This is a mucous membrane. There's epithelial cells here, connective tissue cells. Here are support cells that protect the activity of the bipolar neurons. And there are basal cells, right, because it's an epithelium. Here are some projections from the dendrite that contain receptors for those odorant molecules. And there are other kinds of cells, right, that are stem cells. Where do I have stem cells? Receptor cells, dendritic cells. I don't have that. Okay, but there are stem cells, okay, like this basal cell. And what is a stem cell? Does anybody know what a stem cell is? A stem cell, okay, think of a stem on a plant. How many stems does a plant usually have? How many branches does a plant usually have? A plant has usually more branches or more stems? It usually has more branches. One stem, right? Stem grows up, starts to collect light, it branches into many branches, right? So a plant has one stem. The same thing for a stem cell, all right? A stem cell is a cell that can branch out to become many different other kinds of cells. So it's a very powerful kind of cell. This particular stem cell right here is not acting like a bipolar neuron, but it can differentiate and become a bipolar neuron. So when these bipolar neurons are damaged, then the stem cells can replace them. So that's really interesting, right? Because it's very rare that nervous system cells can be replaced with stem cells, but they can in your nose. Right? And that's because these bipolar cells just have a really difficult life because they're actually what? Hanging outside your body. Okay, so stem cells can regenerate or replace damaged bipolar neurons in your nasal epithelium or olfactory epithelium. All right, so that's the sense of olfaction. I want to go back to gustation. What's the sense of gustation? Oh, here I showed you. Gustation is the sense of taste, right? And you have receptors, so there have to be molecules that bind to receptors on these cells, and these cells exist on a taste bud. So here we're looking at somebody's tongue, and if you look at your tongue, stick it out, look at it in a mirror, and you're going to see that it's not a super flat, shiny surface. How would you describe the surface of your tongue? Kind of velvety, right? It has like a lot of little projections coming off of it. Those projections are what we call papillae, just like those little projections of the dermis into the epidermis. Those were papillae as well. Right, but this is a little bit different form. And a lot of people call those papillae taste buds. You can see them with your naked eye, but those really aren't taste buds. Those are structures. The papillae are structures that contain taste buds. All right, so if we look at these papillae over here, these are what we call valate papillae. There's different kinds. Fungiform are smaller. Valate are a little bit bigger. They're in different locations on the tongue. So here is a valate papillae, which kind of gives your tongue a velvety kind of appearance. And zoom into here. And we're going to look at this area and then zoom into here, right? And I see some cells. So here is a taste bud. And maybe it's made out of 10 or 20 different kinds of cells, or not different kinds, but 20 different cells. So can you see a taste bud with your naked eye if there is one here and I can see the individual cells? What would you need to see a taste bud? A microscope, right? So taste buds are really microscopic, but they line these papillae over here. So papillae is not really the same thing as a taste bud. All right, so a taste bud is buried within the papillae. Here is a little pore that allows saliva and tastant molecules to enter the taste bud, and then they have to bind to receptors. Those receptors then change the electrical properties of this nerve that carries signals, okay, to the gustatory cortex in your brain for appreciation. All right, so here is a taste bud. For gustation, the sensation is a lot simpler. There are primary taste sensations. You have sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and umami. So we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. When you taste something, it's going to be some combination of these 5 senses, and depending on the combination, you can tell what kind of substance it is. Right, so if you put a sugar cube in your mouth, it's not going to be sour, it's not going to be bitter, it's not going to be salty, it's going to be sweet, and so you would be able to tell that that is a sugar cube. Right, umami is a sense of fulfillment. When you eat something, it gives you the sense that you've actually eaten something that is going to help your body. Right, so it's kind of different than sweet, sour, bitter, and salty. So think of some food or some drink that you have consumed that is sweet and sour and salty and maybe even bitter all at the same time. Have you ever eaten or drunk something like that? And because of that proper combination of these things, you were able to tell what it was. Maybe 4th of July. How about a margarita? When you drink a margarita, can you tell it's a margarita? Well, what about the rim? Usually it is salty, right? And it's sweet. And it's sour all at the same time. And depending on exactly how these compounds are mixed together, you think it's a good margarita or not. But nonetheless, you can tell it's a margarita, right? Okay. So that's the gustatory sense. All right, let's talk about vision. Vision, special sensation. All right, vision occurs on your body because we have different kinds of structures. We have accessory structures that help your vision, help your eye see things, but are not directly involved with seeing. So we call these accessory structures, just like the integument has some accessory structures. Now, what are some of these accessory structures? Let's look right here. All right, so your eyebrows. You can't see anything with your eyebrows, but so they're an accessory structure. They prevent debris from falling into your eye, all right, from your top of your head. And if something brushes against your eyebrows, it's going to cause a blink reflex, which is going to protect your eyeball. Your eyelids are there for protection. Eyelashes are there for sensation and protection. So those are accessory structures. An eyelid in anatomy is called a palpebra. All right, so here's the superior palpebra, here's the inferior palpebra, and is it labeled on this slide? It's not, but on one of your slides it is. All right, okay. In the palpebra, here is a gland. Right, and it's called a tarsal gland. Right, here's a tarsal plate. Here are some tarsal glands. Tarsal glands secrete a water plus an oily substance. Right, and that oily substance covers this anterior part of your eye and keeps this anterior part of your eye from drying out. So that's pretty important. So that's one kind of fluid that's secreted onto the surface of your eye. There's another fluid produced by a lacrimal gland, and which commonly we call tears. Here's a lacrimal gland, and this is just a watery and salty solution, right, which is different than what's secreted by a tarsal gland. Nonetheless, this lacrimal gland is still an accessory structure. So in tears, we have mucus, got antibodies, lysozyme is a compound that can break bacteria down, water, and so how do these tears circulate over your eye? Well, the lacrimal gland is superior and lateral to the globe. Sometimes we call the eyeball a globe. And then it flows over the anterior surface of the eye into a little collecting basin that we call the lacrimal punctum. It's a little hole. Then through the lacrimal canaliculus into this bigger collecting chamber that we call the nasolacrimal duct. And that nasolacrimal duct enters the nasal cavity. So when you're secreting a lot of tears, maybe when you're crying or something, what else do you have? You have a runny nose, right? Because that's where these tears, or some of them, wind up, okay, in your nostril. All right, when you're looking at something, you can look to the right, you can look to the left, you can look above and below without even turning your head. And that's because there are muscles that are attached to your eye. And since they're on the outside of your eyeball, we call these extrinsic. Extrinsic or outside, and it just so happens that there are six of them. Right, so there are four that are straightly attached directly to the eyeball, and they don't curve around. So what do we call a muscle that is just straight? I see one here, and I see one here, and I see one here, a straight muscle. Like the straightest muscle in your quadriceps is called the rectus. Right? Rectus femoris. What about those muscles in your stomach that are just straight, superior, inferior? Rectus abdominis, right? So these are rectus muscles. Here's the superior rectus, here's inferior rectus, medial and lateral rectus. Well, when you look at this eyeball, it's kind of hard to tell what is medial and lateral, but in lab it's going to be easy to tell because what's going to be lateral with respect to this eye? If you only see this eye, there's one other thing that you need, and that is the lacrimal gland that's going to be up over here. So then you'll be able to tell that this is lateral, this is superior, and then the others fall into place. All right, so those are four. There are two more that come in at an angle. These are what we call oblique. You have a superior oblique extrinsic eye muscle and an inferior oblique, and they just position the eyeball so that light falls on the proper place of the retina, which is the photosensing or the light sensing part of the eyeball, which is what we're going to look at. All right, layers of the eye. So here is an exam figure, and it is also the quiz for today, which is this thing right here. Here's a nice cross section. I think it's a transverse section of an eye. And so this is anterior, this is posterior. Here is a nerve that's connected to the photo or light sensing part of the eye. This is the optic nerve. Anybody remember what kind of cranial, what cranial nerve optic nerve is? What number? On Olympus's towering top, it's going to be 1 or 2. On Ol. 2, right? Because 1 is olfactory. Yeah, so it's cranial nerve number 2. And it is, remember the other mnemonic, it is purely sensory or afferent, right? It's sensory. It's not mixed. It's not motor. It doesn't control the extrinsic eye muscles. It's just for vision. So that's on one of the posterior sides. The anterior side here is what we call the cornea. And the cornea is transparent so that it lets light into the eye so that you can see it. That is part of the outermost layer. The outermost layer of the cell is what we call the sclera. Usually it has a white color and it's very tough. All right, so the function of the sclera is to give the eyeball its shape and to protect the internal contents. But as it moves to the anterior pole of the eye, it changes nature and it becomes very transparent. And as a result, it's no longer tough. It's easily damaged. And remember in lab I said when you damage your cornea, what is your sensation? It's a very exquisite sensation of pain, right? Okay, so we don't ever want to damage our cornea. So sclera is the most superficial layer. The next deepest layer is the choroid. And I can see blood vessels in the choroid. And that's its job. It contains many, many blood vessels. And it brings nutrients and oxygen, removes waste products away from the interior part of the eye, the next deepest layer, which is highly metabolic. It requires a lot of ATP in order to function, and that is the retina. Right, so I see the retina here. The three layers are sclera, choroid, retina. The retina contains photoreceptor cells. So this is the layer that you can see with, that gives you the sense of vision. And notice there are no blood vessels in the retina. There are only photoreceptor cells. If there are blood vessels in the retina, then you don't have photoreceptors there. And what does that produce? That produces blindness. If you don't have photoreceptors there in that part of your visual field, you will be blind. You won't be able to see light. All right, so that's why blood vessels are in the choroid only. The retina has a couple special places. This big disc right here, or circle, is what we call the macula lutea. It has cells that give you very good vision, color vision, okay, and very fine detail, high resolution, color and very sharp images. And that's almost the place where you have the absolute best vision, but the absolute best place is right in the center of the macula lutea, which is what we call the fovea centralis. It contains a certain kind of cell that we call a cone cell. Cone cells give you color vision and fine detail. As you move away from the macula lutea and fovea centralis, the cone cells diminish in population and another kind of photocell starts to replace them, and they're called a rod cell. So you have two different kinds of photoreceptor cells in the retina. You have rods and cones. Cones give you color vision and fine detail, but the downside to a cone cell is you need bright light in order for them to work. So in order to see color, you need bright light. As you move away from your central vision to your peripheral vision, you have more rod cells. Rod cells are only grayscale. You can see shades of gray, black, and white, right? And that's about it, right? Shades of gray. And also, you can't see fine detail. So things really aren't in sharp focus with a rod cell. So why do we have rod cells? There has to be one advantage to them. The advantage of a rod cell is that they require very little light to work, right? So a rod cell, black and white vision, coarse detail, but they work in dim light. Cone cells, on the other hand, give you color vision, fine detail, but you need bright light. So that's the deal with those two different kinds of cells. And what layer do we find rod and cone cells in? What layer of the eye? The retina. Right, the retina, this deepest layer right here. Okay, well, since we're dealing with light, we need something that looks like a lens. And I see a lens right here. The job of this lens is to help focus light on, in particular, fistful via centralis or macula lutea, and that's really the job of those extrinsic eye muscles, so that light, when it comes in, falls right on this part of the retina. And the job of this lens right here is to help focus it so that it's not blurry by the time it gets to the retina. So here's the lens. The lens can change shape. There also is something else on the eye that has curvature, just like this lens. Do you see something else that has a lot of curvature to it? How about the cornea? Is the cornea flat or is it curved? It's curved. And so the cornea all by itself is acting like a lens, and that is actually the most important focusing element of the eyeball, is just the shape of the cornea. And the shape of the cornea doesn't change normally unless you have a special procedure called a LASIK procedure, right? But it helps focus light on the macula lutea. We said that the lens can change shape, right? And so the lens right here allows you to see things in focus far away or up close, but not both of those distances at the same time. All right, so we can do a quick experiment, even though it's kind of dark in here. Put your hand out way in front of you like that, and look at your fingertips. Focus on your fingertips. All right, and your fingertips are in focus. What can you tell me about all that stuff that's in the background, like the screen? Is it in focus? Try it. Is the screen in focus when you're looking at your fingertips? All right, it should not be in focus. Right? But now, keep your hand up there and focus on the screen. What can you tell me about your hand? Is it in focus? It is not. Right? So you can focus at one distance from your eye at a time, but not from close up to infinity. And it's the job of this lens right here to change that distance where things are in focus. And that process is what we call accommodation. Accommodation is the function. So how does a lens change shape? There's a muscle that pulls on it. It's called the ciliary muscle or ciliary body right here. It's attached to the lens via these suspensory ligaments, and this muscle and these suspensory ligaments then produce accommodation so that you can focus either close up or far away. And as you get older, this lens gets stiffer, unfortunately, and doesn't change quite so fast or enough, so you need different kinds of glasses, right, as a result of that. All right, well, we don't want, like if you're out in bright light, we don't want bright sunlight entering the retina that could damage the retina. And so here is something that can adjust the amount of light that enters the eye. That's called the iris, right? That's a colored part of your eye when you look at somebody's eye. Here is a foramen in the iris, and it's always very, very dark, black looking, because there are no pigments there. It's just a hole. That's called the pupil. So when the iris contracts, the pupil gets smaller. When the iris relaxes, the pupil dilates, right? Constriction or dilation. Adjust the amount of light. Okay, how are we doing on time? Got a little bit more to talk about. Okay, so that's layers. That's some components of the eye. And there are some chambers in the eye. And these chambers are separated by this plane that goes right through the lens and the ciliary body. That area behind, posterior to the lens, which I'm circling with a cursor right now, right, is called the posterior segment of the eye. And the posterior segment of the eye contains a material which we call vitreous humor, which is like jelly. It's very, very viscous, not very fluid-like, and it helps maintain the shape of the eyeball. But it's clear, so light can pass straight through it. That's in the posterior segment. The spaces that are anterior to the lens are what we call the anterior segment of the eye. And this anterior segment actually has two parts. There is one part that is right up against the cornea, that's the most anterior, and then there's another space between the iris and the ciliary body. So we got two different spaces, but they're connected via the pupil, this foramen. So sometimes this space right here is what we call the anterior chamber of the anterior segment of the eye, and this one behind the iris is called the posterior chamber of the anterior segment of the eye, and then posterior to the lens is just what we call the posterior segment, right? Because, and it doesn't have any subdivisions. There is glandular tissue, right, close associated with the ciliary body that secretes fluid, right, that always keeps a separation between the iris and the lens. flows through the pupil into this anterior chamber of the anterior segment of the eye, and then is resorbed by this scleral venous sinus. So that's how this fluid moves. And this fluid is not vitreous humor, it's what we call aqueous humor, because it flows just like water. And it flows right from this posterior cavity to this anterior cavity down in here. If there's a blockage of this sinus, or if this material, if the tissue here produces too much aqueous humor, then pressure builds up in this anterior segment of the eye. Right? And I think you all know what that condition is called. When you have too much fluid in this anterior part of your eye, it's called glaucoma. Right? And glaucoma is pretty dangerous because when pressure builds up over here, it pushes on the lens pushes on the vitreous humor then pushes on the retina, and the retina pushes on the choroid, and that's the bad thing. When the retina pushes on the choroid, blood can't get into the choroid, and as a result, then all of these rod and cone cells can't get enough oxygen and nutrients, waste products build up, rod and cone cells start to die. And so what do we call that when rod and cone cells start to die? That's blindness. So glaucoma produces blindness, and that's probably a really good reason to have your eye checked every year or your eyes checked every year, right? Ever have the exam where there's a puff of air that somebody, a machine blows right onto the cornea, they say, keep your eye open, it's going to be a little obnoxious, and all of a sudden you feel this blast of air. And what they're looking for is the change in shape of the cornea. It kind of dimples, right? It bends in if there's low pressure, but if there's high pressure, when you blast air on it, it just keeps the same shape. And that's one way to diagnose if there's too much pressure in this anterior segment of the eye. All right, so that's important because with glaucoma, you lose your vision a little bit at a time, and if something changes really slowly, it's hard to notice. And sometimes people notice that they're losing their vision when glaucoma is at a very advanced stage, which is unfortunate. So it's good to diagnose that as early as possible, like most other kinds of maladies. All right, so who's got a question on this quiz figure for today? I think I talked about everything on here, the layers. Oh, where the optic nerve attaches to the retina. That's a special place. It's called the optic disc, right? And so we have nerve cells in this area, and we don't have photoreceptor cells. You don't have rods or cones in this area because you have the optic nerve right there. So what can you tell me about vision on this part of the retina? Does it give you color vision or black and white vision? Or the third choice would be no vision. No vision because there are no photoreceptors there. So hence, this optic disc sometimes is what we call a blind spot. And we have a blind spot in our right eye and left eye. And when you look around the room, it's there, but you can't see it because your brain is so important. Your brain says, well, there really shouldn't be a blind spot there. So it fills that information in. So according to the reality that you think you should be seeing. Okay? But in lab, I'll show you how to do a little technique. I'll put something on the board. And if you position your head and eyeball just a certain way, what I write on the board will disappear. And that's the place where your blind spot is, where your optic disc is. So that's actually one way of observing your blind spot. But you have to trick your eye in order to see it. Okay, so that's good for the eye. And I think next time we're going to finish up with hearing and balance. And don't forget, in lab, what do you have to label in lab today? It is this eyeball is one. Oh, and then the old hat one, the sagittal brain, right? So label sagittal brain and then this transverse eye. Okay, so that's it. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet now. You can't sign the lecture sign-in sheet in lab, please, right? So sign it now so I know you're in class. Oh, I was able to get yesterday's lecture online. So check that out. And it looks like I got today's lecture too.